Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we're joined by the distinguished Lynn Boddy, professor of microbial ecology at Cardiff University. After undergraduate studies in biology and mathematical statistics at the University of Exeter, she was interested in any and every type of ecology. A fortuitous position at the University of London led her to studying wood decay processes, which would turn out to be the subject of her PhD. Now, that work actually snowballed into a 40-year exploration of wood decay processes with fungi and fungal ecology at its core. As well as scientifically challenging and environmentally massive consequences, mycelia and their interactions have a huge aesthetic appeal for Professor Boddy. There are so many burning questions when it comes to fungal biology, fungi's relationships to food sources, fungi's relationships to other fungi and microorganisms, and she, along with 40 PhD students, postdocs, and other coworkers, have striven and are continually striving to answer a lot of these questions. Lynn's passion for fungi laces out into studies of mycorrhizal fungi, the rising amateur mycologist community, and nearly every other aspect you could imagine of how fungi will change human lives. There's an obvious joy in her communication of this information to both student audiences and the public at large, and I'm excited to enter an exciting world of fungal battles, life and death struggles, epic hunts for food, and the complexities of fungal intelligence. Lynn, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
It's an absolute pleasure to interview you. It's fun reading your research and hearing about some of the fungal wars and battles that go on the microbial level. So I'm excited to get into it all. I think first what would be really fascinating, and I told a little bit of that story, but maybe the story of how you got obsessed with fungi, how you get obsessed with what they can do, these amazing organisms, and maybe just, you know, the highlights or little synchronicities along the way that led you to become inoculated, as it were.
I think it was a very gradual process. I wasn't introduced to fungi until I was an undergraduate. And at Exeter University, there was a famous mycologist called Professor John Webster. And actually, I didn't do any of his mycology courses because the course that I was doing didn't allow you to take his modules. But he did teach me on a module called soil ecology. And I remember clearly in that module, he told us about mycorrhizal fungi and nematode trapping fungi and decomposer fungi. And I can clearly remember the exam in which there was a question on mycorrhizal fungi and nematode trapping fungi. And I thought, oh, this is so exciting. This is the best exam I've ever done. And so I'm starting to be, I know it sounds strange to be excited in an examination, but there you go. And then gradually over time, as you mentioned at the start, I was lucky enough to get a position to work on actually the ecology of wood decomposition, but it was decomposition processes when I graduated. And of course, it very soon, almost instantly, was apparent that we really needed to know about the organisms involved, and those main agents of decomposition are fungi. And I kept saying to my supervisor, could we have a little bit of a look at the fungi or the invertebrates or do this, that, and the other? He said, no, we've got the money to do work on the processes, how much wood falls in an ecosystem, how quickly it decomposes. And he, of course, was quite right. We had to stick to what we were being paid to do. But I was desperate after that to work on fungi. And I mentioned this to Alan Rayner at the University of Bath, and I said that I wanted to work on the communities of fungi because obviously they were so important, not just the processes. And I said to him also, in this PhD work, I've been working on wood decay on the forest floor, but it doesn't start on the forest floor. We started in the wrong place. It starts in the canopy attached to the trees. So I really want to look at communities in branches, the start of this process. And he said, oh, that's a good idea. Let's apply for a grant. And so we did, and we were lucky enough to get the money to start to work on communities of fungi in attached branches. And so that's what I did next. And that these things together really started everything off. And I gradually got more intrigued with what these amazing organisms were doing and how they were doing it and where they were doing it, not just up in the canopy, but on the forest floor. And subsequently, we came into seeing the battles between fungi and so on and so forth, and hence the next 40 or more years of research.
Maybe we can start at the beginning, because when I think of wood rot fungi, I think of a dead log that's on the forest floor that gets inoculated, spores drop from somewhere, inoculate the log. So I guess in this whole process, how does it start in the canopy?
Yes, that's a very good question. Now, at the time when I started working in the canopy, people have very different views from what they have now. We didn't really know about endophytes. And of course, everybody knows there are endophytes now. In other words, there are microbes in every single plant. We didn't know that. People really thought that trees were sterile. You know, there's nothing in there at all, other than the tree itself. And we started to look at the communities, and we found that in attached branches, very quickly, in less than one growing season of the tree, you suddenly get these huge, long individuals which extend from perhaps near the trunk to perhaps right out along the branch. And they seem to do this, in, as I say, in a very short time, less than one growing season. And it was hard to imagine that they'd really grown to that distance in that time. Even under optimum conditions in the lab, it wasn't very likely. We started to think, you know, how are they doing this? And then it suddenly occurred to us that maybe they're already there as latent propagules, as endophytes. And people were just starting to look at endophytes in grasses and things. Perhaps they were there in this environment which was supposed to be sterile. And you could imagine that if spores were spread in the xylem, which is the water-conducting tissues in the branch, if they were distributed sparsely along there, then they were just sat there effectively minding their own business, not doing anything, just waiting for the opportunity to grow out. And if they were the same genetic material, they were identical, if each of these little propagules, which may be spores or yeast or who knows what, fragments of hyphae, when the right opportunity arose, they germinated, we'll say, in inverted commas, and they grew out as mycelia. If they were genetically identical, when the mycelia met, they would fuse and behave as one, because that's what most basidiomycetes do. Then you could imagine that you could get a long, very long, 5 or more meters long mycelium developing almost instantly. And so the thought was, well, okay, so maybe these propagules are there. Why aren't they growing? Why are they just sat there? And of course, wood, which is functional in the living tree, is full of water. Now, most basidiomycetes don't really cope very well with high water content, so maybe that's stopping them growing. So the hypothesis was that they're already there, the high water content prevents them from growing. So subsequently, I had students who would test that hypothesis. Now, remember, we didn't have molecular tools in those days. Nowadays, you could just go along, extract DNA, and you say, oh, yes, there are fungi here. Couldn't do that 40 years ago. And so what we did was we chopped down living, healthy branches, chopped them up into lengths about 25 centimeters long, something like that, covered the ends with cellophane, and then cut holes in that cellophane and allowed them gradually to dry down. With a reduction in the water content, sure enough, these fungi suddenly developed. There they were. And we had tested that hypothesis and demonstrated that it was probably true.
That is absolutely fascinating. And that gets to this universe of endophytes. And I guess with these propagules, I mean, would they be considered endophytes that when the conditions get right, turn on these saprobic capacities? Or I guess this gets to a broader question. Is there a definitive set of characteristics for endophytes, or is that just a broad term that defines fungi or maybe even propagules living in plants? How we get from endophytes to the actual saprobic fungi that we see on the forest floor, are they one and the same? Or is a propagule living in plant tissue not technically an endophyte, it's just a propagule waiting for the right conditions?
Well, I think that endophyte literally means within plant.
Yeah.
So probably it can be, I guess, anything within a plant. But I have to admit that 40 years ago, when we started to look and think about this, we people were just starting to think about endophytes. We didn't call those that were in branches and wood, we didn't call them endophytes. we call them latently present, because the people who had just started to work on endophytes, they were looking at fungi which actually were in living tissues. Now, although I said these branches are living and perfectly healthy, that's absolutely true. But if you remember from school biology lessons, that wood itself, most of the cells, many of the cells, at least in wood, are not living at all. The xylem vessels that conduct water, they're not living. And so they just pass somewhere there, we assume. And so we didn't call them endophytes, we call them latently present. So they are saprotrophs, decomposers in waiting. That is their role in life. The whole thing is that they're first to get there. That's the advantage of being sat there in that xylem. You're going to be the first. When that branch dies, maybe the canopy is broken and so the water can't be sucked through because there are no leaves there to transpire, or maybe the roots are damaged, maybe there's a fungal pathogen perhaps, or they're damaged in some other way, or there's drought and maybe water stops being pulled up. In those conditions, the xylem dries out and those fungi can then grow from whatever these propagules are, and away they go. And of course, with endophytes in general, some of them are sat there and they actually, as we now know, help plants. Perhaps sometimes they allow plants to grow in, I don't know, saline conditions or toxic conditions, or they produce compounds which inhibit other organisms from eating them.
Right.
These fungi that are the decomposers in waste, and they probably don't do anything like that. They're just sat there probably doing nothing. And then, of course, subsequently, when molecular techniques came along and we could make specific PCR primers, so we could effectively test for specific fungi. We tested for 12 common fungi, which I guessed were latently present, was not necessarily tested by our other methods, on about 11 or so tree species. And yes, we found these things, and we found them in all sorts. We found the same fungi in all sorts of different trees. Now, that came as a bit of a surprise, because the early communities in oak branches that you see in the canopy are different from those in beech, which are different from those in ash and hazel and so on and so forth. The same fungi were actually present in all these tree species. You'd never have guessed that. So why was that? What's going on here? And so our hypothesis then was, wow, they're all there in a sort of a soup, but maybe different tree species dry down in different ways. So ash, Fraxinus, is what we think of as a very dry wood. And that gets certain ascomycetes in particular, very different from oak wood. And so you can imagine that those conditions right at that very start when those branches die are different, and they select for different members of the community. And then, of course, more recently with next generation sequencing, we've been able to aseptically remove woody tissues and have a look at a much wider amount of fungi. And of course, we actually find that there are loads and loads of different species in the xylem in wood. And they're just things probably that have got in there accidentally, and they will never get the chance to do anything. They're not wood decayers. So the story is far more complex than it was in 1980 when we started looking at these things.
As we study more and more the microbiomes of every living thing, I think it becomes more and more apparent how many latent little organisms are present everywhere. And this is a beautiful example of that, basically, that trees have these fungal passengers always, maybe dozens or hundreds of different species, and only certain ones will get selected when that environment they're living in, which is the tree, changes, whether it dries out or whatever happens to the tree when that changes, then it selects for the right fungi that's already present. That's a really powerful concept. And I guess in this big idea of wood rot, you know, for many folks who know about saprobic and wood rot fungi specifically, you have the white rot and the brown rot. I think those are the two general groupings, you know, the white rot dissolving lignin, all the brown material basically in that wood, leaving behind the white material. Whereas in the brown rot, you have decomposing the cellulose, leaving behind the lignin. Are those the general groupings? Are there other ones? Maybe a little bit about these different kinds of wood rot processes that take place.
Yeah, so you're right. And that's the traditional way we've thought of decay, as having brown rots at one end, white rots at the other. The white rot is yes, they use all the components. They use the lignin, hence you don't get the brown color. But ultimately, they actually use absolutely everything in the wood.
Oh.
So they use the lignin, the cellulose, the hemicellulose, everything there is. And so ultimately, they effectively burn that off to carbon dioxide and water. And there are just mineral nutrients left, which are returned to the ecosystem. So that's the white rotters. And as you say, the brown rotters, they might alter the lignin a little bit, but they can't really use it. But of course, nowadays, things are never that simple in biology, are they?
Right.
And we know that there are all sorts of combinations of different types of rot, and there are grey rotters sort of in the middle, and even the white rotters, there's not just one sort of sort. So it's far more complicated, again, than we once thought.
And in any piece of wood that's rotting, there are probably multiple fungal colonies vying for dominance. You have multiple mycelia trying to expand that may have the same capacities. So what are some of the antagonistic relationships that happen in a piece of wood that's rotting between different fungal communities?
Yes, you're absolutely right. A piece of wood is a good source of food for an awful lot of fungi. And by golly, will those decomposers, those saprotrophs, will they fight to get it? My goodness, they certainly will. And they use all sorts of different mechanisms. The basidiomycetes and the xylariaceous ascomycetes are the main wood rotting fungi. And they have all sorts of different mechanisms that they use to try and get the upper hand, so to speak, on any other fungi which happen to be around. So, for example, simple things that they might do might be just to change the pH or change the environment a little bit. They also produce antagonistic compounds. So they produce volatile compounds and diffusible compounds. I often think about the volatile compounds as being a bit like the trench warfare in the First World War. They're doing gas warfare.
Right.
They can do this before they've met. And of course, as soon as they actually do meet, and there are all sorts of other mechanisms which come into play as well. Also, some of them are parasitic on other ones. So you get mycoparasites, in other words, a fungus which is parasitic on another fungus. Some fungi do that as their only way of getting food, but when the wood decay fungi do this, they parasitize as a way of getting territory. Fungus might parasitize something that's already there, and then instantly it can just charge through that mycelium and get hold of all that territory. And then it might, when it comes across another fungus, it might then employ different mechanisms. So there are all sorts of things that can happen. So when one fungus attacks another one, it might use various mechanisms. When it attacks a different fungus, it might use something differently. A bit like, I suppose, if you were thinking about a human boxing match or fight or something. Against one opponent, you might have some tactics and might need totally different tactics against another opponent. So these battles are going on all the time.
It makes it really exciting. I'm never going to look at a piece of rotting wood the same ever again, knowing that it's this microbial battleground. And, you know, one of the things that I love thinking about with fungi is these mutualistic relationships of going between trees. But we have to remember there's a very competitive survivalist side to this organism as well. They're uniquely adapted to have all these different strategies for warding off competitors, like you said, changing their environment. And they're also wildly adaptive in just what food sources they have. That idea of one fungus parasitizing another to then gain access to the wood that's actually the food source, that's fascinating. Now, conversely, are there any defense mechanisms that these fungus employ that you guys have found?
Oh, yes, they employ defense mechanisms too, because it's no good being just a good attacker. You need to defend as well. And so fungi can produce chemicals which can perhaps break down or protect them in some way from the arsenal that's been fired at them by another fungus. And of course, also they may get damaged sometimes. So when a battle commences, they need to be able to repair themselves as well. So there are all sorts of things going on. And we have started looking at this. We initially started looking at the chemistry of the volatiles and things. But of course, nowadays, you can look at actually what genetical things are going on, which genes are being switched on and switched off in inverted commas. So that's quite an interesting thing. But, you know, not every fungus has the same ability of fighting.
Right.
I always think of it a bit like a sports league, where, you know, in a sports competition, you have good teams which are top of the table. When they play against other teams, they beat them most of the time. And then, of course, you have the rather less good ones at the bottom of the league, and they're beaten most of the time. And you have fungi, which are the same. So you have the ones, the top players and the middle teams and the lower teams. But just like, again, in sports competitions, some teams are very good under certain, I don't know, environmental conditions, when they're playing sure. a home match, or maybe on a very soggy, wet pitch. So that can affect the outcome. And also in competitions, sometimes in knockout competitions, you have one of the weaker teams suddenly beats one of the top teams. We call them giant killers.
Yeah.
And you have your giant killing funny in the same way. So these battles are going on, this hierarchy of combative ability. And actually, you mentioned you won't look at a piece of wood the same again. But when you do look at a piece of wood, if you saw a piece of wood in half, you often can see these dark coloured lines in the wood, especially if it's a broadleaf tree. So you'll see very often dark black lines or brown lines, and sometimes brighter colours, orange lines, depending on the fungus. Now, those lines actually demarcate the territories of fungi. So they're a little bit like us humans in that we might put a fence or a wall or a hedge around our homes and gardens. Well, they do this around their territory. They protect their territory. So when they fight, really, they are fighting to get territory, because when they've got access to territory, they can effectively use the wood in that territory at their leisure.
How are they cordoning off these areas?
Well, the hyphae sort of become warped and irregular, and very often they can be coated in melanin or some other compounds, and it is effectively like a wall. And so when you've got fungi which are walled off from each other, I suppose effectively they're probably not really battling anymore. It's a deadlock situation. We often think about fungi as being able to deadlock, in which neither fungus gains headway when they're next to a neighbour. Or yeah. we get replacement, like you get a really aggressive one that replaces another one. And I suspect that those replacing fungi probably tend not to make these walls very much, because, well, why bother? You can charge through and destroy everything in your path and just take the territory. So we've got the deadlock, the replacements. We also get partial replacements when we do these battles, because we do these battles for fun. Well, for science.
I think it's fun, yeah.
And so you sometimes get a partial replacement. Maybe one fungus starts to replace another one, but then suddenly that other one cottons onto the mechanisms that are being employed and manages to defend itself. And so you just get partial replacement. But also, strangely, you get a sort of a reciprocal replacement occasionally, where fungus A starts to replace fungus B in one place, but sneakily, around comes fungus B and replaces fungus A somewhere else. And I've even seen a situation where they completely swap territories. I mean, who knows whether that happens in the real world, but you can sometimes see that sort of thing happening in our model systems in the lab. We started off working on agar culture because you can see these things, but that's too far from the real world. And we work in blocks of wood now. We colonize one block of wood with one fungus, one block of wood with another fungus, put them together and fight.
A battle royale you guys are putting together in the lab. And that actually gets to another really interesting concept, which is how these fungus, maybe even after these initial wars that are going on, or maybe the wars are constant as new fungus are always introduced, but how do they then forage out for more food? You know, once they've completely decomposed or soaked up all the food in the piece of wood they're living in, how do they forage for more wood? How do they get out there and find new food sources?
Well, many fungi can't. They effectively eat themselves out of house and home. And all they can do is then produce their fruit bodies with their millions of spores, which they send off on the wind or perhaps spread by invertebrates or something like that, in the hope of the very slim chance that they will land on a suitable resource. And of course, we know that they do get that opportunity. One of those propagules will now and then, because decay occurs somewhere else. So at a revolutionary time, they've evolved to make the right numbers of millions of spores to actually be successful. So those types of fungi we call resource unit restricted. They're really restricted to their resource, and all they can do when their food runs out, or probably before it runs out, is to make spores to spread somewhere else. And actually, different fungi fruit at different times in their lives. So those fungi which tend to get into wood early on are very often not very good fighters. And so they very quickly commit themselves to reproduction so that they get out before somebody takes over their territory.
Right.
Whereas other fungi, which are good fighters, or maybe can cope with very harsh conditions. So in the centers of trees, in, for example, in oak trees, which the heartwood is often full of nasty compounds, and not many fungi can cope with that. Those which have evolved to cope, they've got an environment where they're not going to be under attack very much. And so, and they've got huge volumes in the centers of these ancient trees that they can decompose and use as food. So they don't have to commit themselves to reproduction early on. You know, it could be 20, 30, 40, 100. We don't know how long, many years before they make their fruit bodies. Anyway, these are all the resource unit restricted fungi, which spread by spores. But there are a few, I suppose, probably a relatively small number of fungi which actually go out in search for food. They grow out from their wood as mycelium in soil. Now, soil is a very dangerous place to be. Mycelia are very, you know, we eat mushrooms because they are nutritious. Equally right. Well, you grow out as mycelium in soil, you're fair game to everything that's there. And very many soil invertebrates do feed on fungi because they are so nutritious compared with, certainly compared with wood, but also compared with leaf. You know, you have to eat far less fungus to get the nutrients you require. So
right.
It's not a safe place to be. Also, the soil is full of many microbes. There are other fungi out there. There are bacteria. Everybody's trying to eat you if you're a fungus. And so those fungi which grow out, they don't grow out, they don't stay as individual hyphae. They wouldn't have much of a chance. But these hyphae, instead of spreading away from each other, so usually when a colony develops, you can see this when you grow it on plates of agar jelly, you inoculate in the center, the fungus grows out, and right. Each of the individual hyphae, the fine filaments, grow away from each other. They don't grow over, they don't want to cross over with each other because they'd be competing for the same bit of food. They want to get as much food as they can, so they grow away from each other, they diverge. But when they're growing in soil, they don't diverge anymore, they converge, they grow together. And they form these more or less linear organs by hyphae intertwining around each other, and sometimes forming a thick outer rind, which are differentiated internally, and can even wow. look a bit root-like. And so they form these much larger organs, which we can actually see. But of course, these are protected. If they're covered in a waterproof coating, I suppose a bit like us wearing a raincoat, water and the light doesn't get in, but equally well, nothing gets out. So they're then conduits. They're protected on the outside, but they're conduits along which water and mineral nutrients can spread, so that the fungi grow from the tips usually, and then they form these cords behind. We just call them cords. There are some which are a bit different. You're familiar with the honey fungus, aren't the armillaries, which yeah. form these boot laces. They operate a bit differently. We call them rhizomorphs, not cords, because rather than growing as individual hyphae from the tip and then forming cords later, rhizomorphs grow, the whole organ grows from the tip. But either way, whether they're cords or rhizomorphs, they have got these protective organs then, which are in the soil. Much harder to eat because they're often protected around the outside. They often have crystals around the outside, which deters invertebrates from grazing on them. Anyway, they grow in, well, there's two things they can do. They could grow in search of new resources, but also over a long time, they effectively form a network on the forest floor, and they can sit and wait for resources to arrive. Mm. So the branches which fall from the canopy or when whole trees fall down, suddenly the food has come to them as well. So you can go and look for it, but equally well, you can be there waiting. And some of these systems are very old. I mean, we know in North America, obviously, that there are these huge armillaria systems, which are probably 1,000 years old. But the cord formers, we first discovered this, the size of these systems in the early 1980s when we started looking at cord formers in the soil. And we dug up on site. It was only a 40 meter long site, and I don't know, maybe 20 or so meters in another direction. We dug up all the dead oak trees, small dead oak trees. We isolated the fungi. We paired them all up in agar culture. And if they're the same genotypes, they fuse together. So right. we could then get a map of where you got the same individual. And we showed then, all that time ago, that you have these very big individuals, you know, 10, 20, 30 meters in extent. So you've got these big systems on the forest floor. But to me, one of the most exciting things, and a very early piece of work, which I was involved with, we showed how they behave and change when they find new resources.
Right.
So one of my first students, I was working in Cardiff by then, with as a postdoc, Alan Rainier at Bath, because we had a student who was going to look at what happens when these core systems find pieces of wood, because of course nobody had done anything like that before.
And how do they know where to go? How do they pass nutrients? It gets into a lot of questions.
Yeah, so they don't have to know where to go. When they get very close, there may be gradients of nutrients that they can sense. But we did experiments in trays of soil straight from the field. We didn't autoclave it, any of those anthropologists tend to do. We just collect the soil from the field, put it into trays of soil of 24 centimetres by 24 centimetres. We put a wood block colonized by one of these fungi onto the tray of soil. And we did other things like put small wood blocks or big wood blocks or even plastic bottle caps elsewhere on the tray, let the fungus grow out from the wood block and fills the tray and starts to thicken up a bit and make these cord systems. But the really exciting thing, this is one of the most exciting experiments which spawned so much more work over the years, with the sulfur tuft fungus, when that mycelium encounters a new block of wood, it colonizes it, but then it sends messages back to the rest of the mycelium elsewhere. So it thickens up, forms a thick cord between the original block of wood and the one it's just found, and the rest of the mycelium is effectively told by some means. This isn't just the successful way to search. We found it over in this way.
Right.
So that mycelium dries back. Those nutrients are recycled and probably diverted, probably along this new cord. We've done lots of experiments showing that the nutrients are preferentially sent along these new systems. And suddenly, you've got nothing else where you had a whole tray full of soil. But all you've got then is this thick link between these wood resources. And then the new resource that the fungus had colonized, eventually, it grows out of there. And off it goes again. Now, to me, that was absolutely remarkable. We had no reason ever to guess that that's what would happen. Nobody really knew it, that these core forming fungi were there, you know.
Right.
So this was remarkable. And then we found that another fungus, Panrachete velutina, when we did that same experiment and it found a new resource, it didn't. It colonized it, but it didn't send these messages. Oh. However, so that was a bit of a surprise.
Yeah.
But then we in this same big experiment, we had a little block of wood to start with and a great big new resource. We did this with the sulfur tuft fungus and this fungus Panrachete velutina. Now, when the sulfur tuft finds this new huge resource, very quickly all of the rest of the mycelium dies back, and this is the place to be before it carries on growing. Well, when Panrachete finds this great big huge resource, Panrachete obviously decides, yes, this is an important place to be. This is a good food supply. And then it does send messages elsewhere.
Wow.
They have different strategies. The one strategy, the Hypholoma, yes, I'll eat anything I can and the mycelium will concentrate there. But the Panrachete sort of has a much, shall we say, longer range or much more choosy in some ways. It wants these bigger things and it doesn't change its strategy until it finds a big lot of food.
And now what was so fascinating about the sulfur tuft experiment is when you moved that original block, right, to a new experimental field. So you had the original block colonize, form its cord with the secondary block, and then you moved the original block.
Yeah, so you've moved on 30 years in research time.
Oh, wow.
So in the intervening 30 years, we did all sorts of things to find out how fungi fight, how they move nutrients around.
Before we skip ahead 30 years, I didn't realize that. You know, there are so many questions to answer about how these messages are getting passed along. To me, it wasn't even clear exactly how nutrients are passed along through the mycelium. But Were there any insights there? Did you guys figure out any mechanisms? And especially with this odd discerning fungus, what triggers it to say now we send signals versus now we don't? Are they electrical signals? I can see why it took 30 years to just explore those questions.
You'd think in 30 years we'd know the answer to that, but we're still not really knowing the answer. And that, to me, is one of the big questions that we really still need to answer is, what are these messages? As you said, are they electrical stimuli? I mean, the chances are quite good that they are. And occasionally people have dabbled and seen that obviously the fungi do have electrical potentials. Is it a nutrient thing? Can the fungus detect that there are differences in nutrients? Is it a water potential, a water flow thing? Or is it combinations of things? And we still don't really know the answers to these questions. And I really need some cell biologists to really get to grips with this. And in other words, somebody who knows a little bit more than a humble ecologist than I do. But I think these are burning questions. We did lots of work actually analysing the network architecture. We started off when fractal geometry became in vogue. We started using fractal geometry to describe these patterns, because before that it had been very qualitative. So that was very nice. We could start to do quantitative things. And then more recently than that, in the last 15 or so years, I've collaborated with Mark Fricker at Oxford, and we've done a lot of work on analysing the networks in the same way as mathematicians and physicists analyse other networks, like, I don't know, the rail networks, road networks. We have networks throughout our lives, the internet, everything, and there are lots of mathematical tools, and we've started analysing fungal networks in that sort of way. So we know quite a lot, but it's like everything, isn't it? The more you know, the more you know you don't know.
Exactly.
I'm coming towards the end of my research career now, but it would be very easy to do it, to spend another 40 years. I'm sure that the questions would pile up. Of course, we would understand a lot more.
And especially when you think that I'm sure different species build their networks in different ways. I mean, you get into this question.
Yes, they do. And obviously, they've been doing experiments effectively for millions of years over very evolutionary time, perfecting the best network. But as you say, different species have different network organizations. So they've come up with different solutions. And they're also probably balancing different things. So there are competing demands. So there's the demand to get somewhere quickly, but other demands are to be resilient, because there are those eating organisms out there, and I've said that they're well protected with their cords, and of course they are, but that doesn't mean that they don't get broken and they don't get eaten or they don't get fractured in some other way.
Right.
So some of the fungi have evolved to be much more connected than others, so that you can damage a lot more of those connections and yet still be connected, say from a central woodblock to an outside point. They've evolved different priorities and different balances, and hence you get these different patterns of networks, which you can see visually as well. Some of them are really, really quite beautiful, you know, like spiders, webs.
And so your two-block experiment was really seminal in diving into this question of how do these networks form the way they do? What are the structure of these networks? How are they making these decisions? But then when I fast-forwarded 30 years, that gets to that next interesting concept, which is how intelligent are these networks?
Yeah.
And do they have memory?
Do they have memory, and are they intelligent? Well, they're not intelligent in the way that we are. And people often think that, you know, these are like brains. And of course, they're not really like brains. But they make very simple decisions about which way to go and that sort of thing, which looks like complex behavior, but it's not the same as our brains. We shouldn't think in any way that they're like our neuronal interconnections in our brain. But I had a Japanese visitor, Yu Fukasawa, who came over a couple of years ago, and we started to look at this question of memory in some sort of sense. And we did various things, but one of the simplest things we did was, as you said, we had similar systems to those which we'd used originally, where one fungus grows out and it encounters another one. And what we did was we removed, as soon as the fungus had started to colonize that new block, we chopped off all of the mycelium and took the original block away and put it on a new tray of soil and just watched how that grows out. And of course, nowadays we can do, as I say, these quantitative things. We can capture the image and do image analysis. And what we found was that the fungus grows out more and more quickly on the side that had originally connected with that new piece of wood. So in some sort of sense, it, in inverted commas, it had remembered. Now, it's not memory in the same way. It's not memory in the same way as you or I remember. But there's something there. Now, it might be as simple as the fact that maybe once it had started to colonize that new block, maybe on the original new block, there was more mycelium, perhaps in the wood on that side. You know, it could be all sorts of different reasons for why it did that. But nonetheless, some sort of memory. That really was, again, that was the next big, really remarkable thing about these mycelial networks. And of course, there's all sorts of things which we want to find out now. Well, actually, we did. It was a rather bigger experiment than what I've just said, because we had different side wood blocks growing out to these, the fungus grew from originally.
Yeah.
When they were growing from the small wood blocks to the big wood blocks, and we put a small wood block on a new area of soil, we actually found that very often the fungus no longer could grow out of that little wood block. It's almost as if when it grew from the little one to start with and found the big one, it was as if it transferred all of everything that it had, all of its energy and its nutrients and everything that it got to the new place that was much bigger and better than this tiny one. It's, you know, it's almost as if it's packed with fangs and left home to use an anthropomorphic scenario. And so different size combinations do different things, and we need to move on with some more relatively simple experiments, I guess, to see what, how long this memory in inverted commas is. How can it be that a piece of wood can remember the way to go, and how far can these networks grow out and still have this sort of memory? You know, there are all sorts of very, very basic fundamental questions which we need to try to answer.
And even what does packing its bags mean? You know, is it a transfer of just all of the quote-unquote energy? What does that really mean? And it's hard not to anthropomorphize this and think of it as a brain or, you know, the consciousness jump to the big block, but that's not necessarily what's happening here. But, you know, they're tough concepts to try to work our head around because it's a different organism. It's not us. It's not animal. It has a different approach. Everything about it is unique and kind of challenges our perspectives.
It certainly does. So again, there's another 40 years of work worth of work, I think, which can come on there for whoever wants to follow on. You know, we're never going to be short of exciting experiments. And interestingly, in this day where we use so much modern technology and all these molecular approaches and very snazzy, clever, microscopic techniques, you know, amazing things, we can still do a lot of very interesting observational biology on things which we still don't know very much about. This always strikes me as really rather strange. I mean, people are always saying to me, well, didn't we already know that? Well, no, nobody did know it. You know, yes, it's so simple. And it is strange. We need to know this because these organisms are so important to our planet. As you know, without fungi, we would not be here for two main reasons. One, because of the mycorrhizal fungi. Nearly every plant is fed by mycorrhizal fungi, and certainly there are endophytes in all plants. So that's the one thing plants just, on the whole, could not cope.
We wouldn't have plants, yeah.
We wouldn't have plants, so we wouldn't be here. And then the second crucial reason is the decomposers, which people do sometimes forget. The decomposers are a bit of a nuisance because they rot our food and homes and everything. But again, the decomposers, like these wood decay species, are absolutely crucial to our planet because without them, we would be up to our armpits, effectively, in dead stuff. The basidiomycetes are the only things really which can decompose lignin to any great extent. And they have to. It's not just these physical inconveniences because there's dead stuff everywhere. All of the nutrients would be locked up in that dead stuff. They have to decompose it to release those nutrients back to the plants so the plants can carry on growing. So why is it that so few people on our planet still they don't realize that fungi are important? They just think that they're in use. They're so important. And yet there is still so much that we don't know about them and so much basic fundamental information.
And even between those two categories of, you know, fungi that are rotting dead things and fungi that are connecting trees, how many of the biological mechanisms are the same? You know, when a fungi decides what tree to give its nutrients to versus a fungi that's choosing a food source from a saprobic point of view, are those using the same channels? Is that some similar capacity? And you just answered beautifully the question I was going to ask is, why is this all important? Why do we need to understand wood rot fungi, as someone who's more familiar with it than probably anyone on the planet, save maybe a lucky few? Why is this so important? And you've just answered that beautifully. Not only would we be buried, but we need all those nutrients from all those pieces of wood that have left the ecosystem. We need all those nutrients cycle back in. But is there any overlap between saprobic or wood rot fungi and mycorrhizal fungi? And that's just something in reading your work and reading about mycorrhizal fungi, you come away with, you know, like I said, a lot of these same biological mechanisms seem to be at play. Is there any connection there? And I know there are some fungi that are thought to have potentially both capabilities, some latent saprobic capabilities, but also mycorrhizal.
Yes. Yeah, so, for example, if we think about the ectomycorrhizal fungi, that is those fungi which predominantly form mycorrhizal associations with forest trees. The ectomycorrhizal basidiomycetes actually evolved from saprotrophic ancestors. So you're quite right that there are very many abilities and mechanisms which both have, because they come originally from the same sort of place. Although some mycorrhizal fungi don't have very much in the way of abilities as far as decomposition is concerned, other ones certainly do. They've retained those ancestral abilities. So, I mean, I guess maybe the fly agaric, the classic one that people think of, the red one with the little white spots on that pixies sit on in children's story, that's a mycorrhizal fungus and still has quite a lot of decomposer ability that is carried with it. Other ones have lost that ability. Probably they put their efforts in other directions. And another thing from a wood decomposer fungus point of view, was quite an interesting study. It was a couple of years ago now, done with this agricultural university in Uppsala. And they have quite a lot of researchers who are interested in ectomycorrhizal fungi, and they have researchers who are interested in decomposers. And they've got a big collection of decomposed wood decay fungi, wood decomposer fungi. And they screened all of those wood decay fungi in their collection to see whether any of them make mycorrhizas with trees. And some of them certainly showed abilities in that direction, but probably not in the way that you necessarily think of these very strong mycorrhizal fungi,
right,
but they certainly were forming relationships. So again, it's like we said with the white rotters and brown rotters, that's not black and white like that, and equally well with the mycorrhizal fungi and the decomposers. It's not a black and white situation.
And it's just fascinating to think that something that's evolved for, you know, a certain purpose for millions of years still retains some element of that other potential evolutionary path. It still retains that. And I guess it's that idea that if it's not biologically, if it's not using up too much energy, or if it's not something that inhibits the organism's ability to survive, it'll hang on to that capability. And it always strikes me that fungi have this incredible ability to adapt like that, where you think they're just black or white, they just do one thing to survive, and they can pull different tricks out of their tool bag, whether it's decaying dead things when they're mycorrhizal. I know some fungi are adapted also to hunt small invertebrates if they need to. There's this whole amazing world of adaptable fungi. And something I think I passed over when we were talking about decomposition, we did the great breakdown of that spectrum of decomposing rotting wood. What's actually happening there? I mean, when a fungi is breaking down wood, we all know fungi have their stomachs on the outside. They're secreting enzymes to break down substances that they then absorb. But what's happening in the case of wood? Are there special compounds that they're making? Or just a little bit about that process?
Yeah, so it's a very complicated process, the breakdown of wood. As you say, they secrete enzymes outside. And now, of course, that's a bit risky, isn't it? We have internal digestion, and the food that we digest, most of it is going to come for us to use.
It's going to be good for us. Yeah,
exactly. And we have microbes in our guts, and they'll get some of that food too. If you do your digestion outside, do something that can break down these complicated molecules, which most things can't, and you're releasing them outside, and then you have to soak them up, there's great chance for other organisms to steal. This is when we start to think about, you know, what is going on? Are there other organisms there? And if you'd have asked me 40 years ago in wood, were bacteria in there doing anything? I probably have said, oh, no, I shouldn't think so, not very often. However, what a great place to be. You might not have these digestive mechanisms, but what a great opportunity to steal things. But of course, nowadays, there's increasing interest in bacterial interactions.
Yeah.
There's a whole scope of different things that can happen, isn't it? There's bacteria can steal food from fungi because of the mechanisms we've just talked about. Equally well, bacteria can do some things that fungi can't. They can make some chemicals that the fungi can't, which might be useful to them. Some bacteria can fix nitrogen. Nitrogen's very scarce in wood, relatively scarce, so that would be a great asset if you could ally yourself with a nitrogen-fixing bacteria. There's a scope for that. So bacteria can take things from the fungus and probably other ones can give, and vice versa. So the fungus can take things. So the whole spectrum of things going on. Now, of course, fungi do so well and have evolved these amazing mechanisms and rot these solid lumps of wood better than anything else. One, because they've got the enzymic capacity, but two, they've got the mycelial way of life. And mycelium lets them get to places other organisms cannot get. Unicellular organisms are well fitted for an aquatic environment, if you like. But mycelium can get into these solid objects. Now, how cunning it and can go through soil in the same sort of way as we've described. How cool would it be for a bacterium to be able to hitch a ride effectively on mycelium? And of course, this has been shown particularly by a group of researchers in the Netherlands, although others of us have also worked on this subsequently. They've shown that actually some bacteria can spread along hyphae. Now, it would be wrong to think that they just sit on a hypha and the hypha takes them somewhere, because that's not what happens. So bacteria can use the hyphae as effectively a mycological motorway. If they're motile bacteria, they can move along. They can actually move in both directions. And it seems that some bacteria are better suited to doing this than others, and perhaps they've got some preference for the species of fungi which they move along. But also, we started to look at the relationship of bacteria with fungi when we were having these fungal battles. We found that sometimes you might get a bacterium, perhaps, that if it's present on one fungus, maybe that fungus then beats another one. But if the bacterium isn't there, maybe it's not so competitive. And vice versa, the presence of a bacterium might hinder a competition. So the complexities they're just immense.
Complexities of just the fungal-to-fungal interactions in these environments, much less adding in the bacteria, whether they're mercenaries in some fungal war, or they're enlisted as, you know, farmers of nitrogen by a fungi, or thieves in the night staking nutrients or using it as a highway. I mean, it's really, really fascinating, the whole ecology at play within rotting wood that we don't appreciate, that's so vitally important. And what is the environmental significance of this process, of this wood rot process? I mean, we know about the nutrient cycling. Is there any other environmental impacts this whole process has?
Yeah, absolutely, there is. And that is to do with sequestration of carbon, with climate change. If decomposition rate increases because of elevated temperatures, then soil carbon and dead wood resources will decrease with increase in CO2 evolution into the air. So that quite clearly is hugely important. It may be that there are ways perhaps of sequestering carbon as a result of fungi. So for example, maybe the brown rot fungi, which don't use all of the wood, maybe they would be worth exploring to see whether we could inoculate wood with brown rot, with more brown rot fungi, so that you don't get complete decomposition so quickly. So there are all sorts of possibilities. And also environmentally, wood decay fungi have these amazing enzymic abilities. They can break down these really complex molecules. The lignins are probably the most complicated, or amongst the most complicated naturally produced molecules there are. But there are other complex molecules too, so pollutant molecules, for example.
Right.
So there's good scope for using some of these fungi in the future, I'm sure, for breaking down pollutants.
So there are applied potentials for these wood rot fungi. Mm-hmm. just to relate this back to mushrooms we all know and love, maybe we go with the premier level fungi, you know, the top of the Premier League fungi when it comes to wood rot. What are some examples of the most dominant wood rot fungi we might find in an ecosystem, and then some lesser known, maybe fungi that we can all relate to?
Yes. So one of the fungi that I've worked on a lot over the years is called Phanerichthys velutina. And it doesn't have a common name, I don't think, because it's not something you really particularly ever notice. It really is, the fruit body is just a skin on the underside of wood on the forest floor. Hmm. And yet it produces these amazing mycelial networks, still hidden from most of us. On the other hand, things like the sulfur tuff fungus, we see those fruit bodies everywhere, that decomposer, and again, it's an important one, and Megacolibia platyphylla, again, these big fruit bodies which forms huge systems. The stinkhorn fungus, Phallus impudicus, you know, the smell of it and the sight of it and the attracting of the flies, that forms these huge networks in soil. There are iconic species which are hugely important. And there are ones which we would think of as just some little bit of fluffy fruit body, not much, which again have hugely important roles.
Just because I come from a background of foraging for gourmet mushrooms, where do oyster mushrooms and chicken of the wood mushrooms fit into this picture? I mean, are these really successful decomposers of wood? Are they the ones that, you know, might have to get lucky to get an upset and establish themselves? Or where do those two fall?
Yeah, so that's very interesting, actually. So things like chicken of the woods and these other fungi, which form great big fruit bodies, whether they're edible or not, right, we often, well, they must be important. We see them all the time.
Right.
And a lot of the recent works, which we haven't had time to talk about, perhaps that's a scope for another program. I'm working a lot nowadays on the decay of the central tissues of wood, so what we call heart rot. So chicken of the woods, Lepidosporus, it is a heart rot fungus, and there are other things like the Ganodermas, which are heart rot fungi, which we see all the time. We thought, well, we're going to find these all the time, and certainly we do find Lepidosporus a lot on oak, but the Ganodermas, we thought they would be the dominating thing in the heart rot of beech trees, but they're not. It's just that they're dominant in our minds because we see them. Yes, okay, they are there and they are important. But the point is, there are an awful lot of other things which are there and important. It's just that they produce perhaps smaller fruit bodies or more ephemeral fruit bodies. You know, our human perceptions of fruit bodies, they're hints of what's going on, but they do not tell us anywhere near the whole story. They're hints. Those edible fungi, they are important. Lepidosporus is an important heart rot fungus. Pleurotus is an important wood decayer too in the natural world.
Like you said, it would probably take another podcast to do your current work justice, but that was a question I had, is what questions your lab is looking at now? And then maybe a hint at some of the great unanswered questions that you see just in this area of wood rot.
Wow, that's the skies are the limit.
Small question, yeah.
Yeah, so for the hint of really important questions, I still think a really important question with mycelial systems is how these messages are sent. And just, we still don't know enough about how mycelial activity. So that's a really big question still. And we know that they're important too because they shunt nutrients all around the ecosystems, whether they're mycorrhizal fungi or whether they're the decomposers. So they're very important. But as you say, the recent work I've been doing on heart rot fungi is really quite fascinating. And I guess people have been interested in heart rot since the early 1800s, when the German foresters wanted to know from their scientists, you know, what's rotting our trees? We want to sell these trees to timber, and their insides are rotted. You know, we need to know why. And at the time, they didn't even know it was fungi. And people started working on this, and they got the ideas of pathogens and decomposers completely muddled, and some people still do. Some people think that because a fungus is growing on a tree, it's a killer. Okay, sometimes it is, with, say, our malaria melia or something, and some of the other fungi. But many of these fungi we see fruiting on standing trees, they're decomposers of those central tissues, those central heartwood tissues. And they're not killers because those tissues are dead and you can't kill something that's already dead.
Right.
They're just important recyclers. They happen to be doing that decomposition, that recycling, in a vertical structure rather than on the forest floor. And if you look into the center of some of these hollow trees, you'll see roots coming down from the inside of trees, sort of air, I'm not sure if aerial roots is really the right term, but they grow downwards from inside the trees into this decomposing wood, and they're almost certainly getting nutrients from there. So you're getting recycling actually within the tree. The heart rot fungi are hugely important as recyclers and also as creators of habitat, because, you know, worldwide there's over 1,000 species of birds and mammals whose homes are in hollow trees. In the UK alone, there's about 1,700 species of invertebrates, which depend on this sort of habitat. So it's hugely important habitat. But we're losing, especially in Europe, we're losing most of our big trees. We're losing this heart rock habitat. People think it's a bad thing. Oh, look at that tree. That's rotting. That's terrible. It's not safe. Take it down. And for all sorts of reasons, we're losing our big trees and we're losing all this habitat and the fungi, some of which are now quite rare, associated with them. So this is where much of my current work lies in this direction.
It's important to actually keep these trees that may have had their whole heartwood rotted out. It's actually important to keep those there.
It's really important. They're really important habitat. People think of them very often as being a dead tree. That's no use. Whereas, in fact, it's of huge use and importance to the environment.
And I've heard much the same about even dead logs on the forest floor as being an incredibly important environment as well.
Absolutely. There's been a habit, I think, amongst lots of people, and perhaps some foresters and gardeners and whatever, to have this tidy mentality, to let's clean up. And of course, also, we've taken a lot of wood to use as fuel wood. But in most of our woodlands, there's very little wood on the forest floor. If you go to something which approaches a primeval forest, not that we have any in Europe other than a few minute patches, but if you go to an undisturbed, if there were such, it would take you half an hour to walk 100 yards because there are these huge trees come down
right.
To clamber over. You know, the amount of dead wood is phenomenal. We don't have that in our ecosystems. And so one of the most important conservational things you can do is to allow dead wood to accumulate rather more than it is now and provide that habitat. And indeed, those nutrient reservoirs.
That's a project that Bay Area Applied Mycology, where I am here in the San Francisco Bay Area, they did a project of inoculating fallen trees and dead wood, because here it's such a big deal. Obviously, we're going through this wildfire season to clear out every piece of dead wood on the ground. And I think part of the purpose of inoculating the wood was to say, well, if we do this properly and they're actually inoculated, you know, this is a very useful part of the ecosystem rather than just that instinct, like you said, to just clear it all out of there. I guess if you can give some kind of overview on your lab there at the University of Cardiff, what has the lab grown into over your 40 years of research? And then maybe any questions on the horizon or any exciting people within the lab and what questions they're looking at?
Yeah, so actually we're becoming a rather smaller lab than we have been now. As I suppose I'm one of these days, I probably will have to retire, I dare say.
I can't imagine that with the amount of passion and excitement you have. I can't imagine that, but I guess it's inevitability.
I suppose so. I can't imagine it at the moment either. So we have a relatively small team of people at the moment, but we've shifted our emphasis over the years and looked at all sorts of things. So I am still interested in climate change, and I still got a lot of that, but that really is a story for another day. And yeah. I still do a little bit with networks, but most of our emphasis and most of the students and postdocs and what have you in the lab are working on decay of standing trees. So the heart rot story that I started to tell, we don't know very much about it. Nobody really has worked on this, and so we're doing that. But also, you mentioned the inoculating of fallen wood, and you're quite right. Lots of people are becoming interested in inoculating wood and inoculating with rare and endangered species. So there's a lot of that been going on the forest floor in North America and in continental Europe. But we're also interested in trying to inoculate fungi into standing trees, because there are rare and endangered species in standing trees, and also to try to get relatively young trees we're trying to ancientize them or veteranize them, get to the stage where we have got hollows and to get there more quickly, because trees take 300, 400, whatever years to do that. We need to do it more quickly. We've got a big gap in habitat. Our biggest trees are coming towards the end of their life, and there's nothing in between the young plantings and these ancient veteran trees to fill that habitat gap. So that's one of the things that I've got several people working on, is veteranizing, inoculating central heartwood tissues? And also, are there things that we can do in the canopy to encourage fungi to develop? Are there treatments we can do by girdling or defoliating or whatever? So that's our main push at the moment. So you're saying, are any of these researchers interesting or going to do great things? Well, I would say every single one of them. If you asked me who had been the greatest influence in my career, one might think of some of the famous mycological names of the past, or ones that I've been lucky enough to help me to learn to write and start me on my research career. They certainly would be there. But perhaps the biggest influence has been the students. And so you think about research students with the questions that they're asking, and that certainly is true, but also undergraduate students as well, because students are all asked questions, and at a first glance you might think, well, that's a silly question, but it's never a silly question if they want to know. And people have often said to me, well, why is this? And suddenly you think, oh my goodness, I've believed that for 30 years and I don't know why. Why is this?
Right.
So very often it has been the students who have really triggered things and make me think. So they have been a huge influence on me. And I hope that perhaps I've been a little bit of an influence on them. And I would think that if I've inspired a handful of students to go on to be interested in fungi and to do research, well, of any biological kind, then I think it's all been worthwhile.
Well, I think you're probably inspiring people just listening to you speak right now on this show. And I know that I got inspired just reading about your work. So I think when you get as excited as you are about these questions, you can't help but infect other people with that enthusiasm. Kind of a broader question, what do you think about the amateur mycological community? Because that's something that I'm very much a part of. It's huge here in the US, people getting interested in mycology. How do you see that community meshing with folks like yourself and your lab? And what do you see the potentials there in terms of the potential for change, and especially on the applied mycology front?
Well, you know, I think that the amateur community is hugely important. I mean, I couldn't overstate this really for lots of different reasons, but perhaps I'll just mention two. One, certainly in the UK, and indeed in quite a lot of countries too, much of the taxonomic ability resides in the amateurs nowadays. So they are hugely important from that perspective. They're also hugely important because they collect data, they collect records. If you were going to get a grant to do this, it would cost you millions. These people are doing it for free. Just to finish with an example to show how important this is.
Yeah.
I've heard about the first piece of work which we did on climate change and fungi. And it was in the early 2000s, a professor from part of the University of London, Royal Holloway College, Alan Gange, phoned me up and he said, you know, my dad was an amateur mycologist and he started recording fungi in 1950. And he and his friends go out several times a week, every week of the year since 1950. And he's recorded absolutely everything that they found. He identified them all, or verified the identification, recorded them all. Or they were on just pieces of card for every record in those days. And when he retired, his son, Alan, the son, said to Ted, the father, you know, here's a computer, digitize all these data. And the father did this. And then Alan Gann was actually a professor of entomology. And he said, I don't know much about fungi, but I really like your take on this. I've been analyzing my dad's data. And I said, I just would like to know whether you think they're as interesting as I do. And can I come and visit you? And I said, oh, yes, please do. And he came. And from the first graph he showed me, I was beyond excited because he told me a very simple plot. We did eventually publish this in Science. And this was the first evidence that fungi are being affected by climate change. And what he'd done, because his dad and friends had gone out so often, so throughout the year, not just in the autumn fruiting season, throughout the year, they had records of everything. We could see when each species or each of the main species in the data set started fruiting, you know, when the first records were, and when there were the last records every year. And we plotted this over time. And of course, we plotted the average first region and last region date for 200 or so species of fungi. And of course, the line jiggles up and down every year because, as you know, the weather in a particular year will alter when things through. But more or less, from 1950 to about 1978, it jiggled around the first region date and the last region date on average, jiggled around a bit, but it was always around the same sort of level. You know, if you could put a straight line through it, it was horizontal over time, nothing much had changed.
Yeah.
But then come 1978, things did change. And we started to see that the average first fruiting date of fungi was getting earlier in the autumn, and the average last fruiting date was getting later. And this carried on year, the difference is getting bigger and bigger. In other words, the fruiting season is getting longer all the time. Before 1978, it was about 33 days on average in this part of Britain. Now it's double that, something like 72 days, and probably next year it'll be 73 days and so on. And this was correlated, lots of the food and things were correlated with environmental variables. So clearly climate change is affecting fungi from a fruiting perspective. And if fruiting is being altered, then other aspects of the ecology are.
Right. Yeah,
one of the big things that we found in this very early piece of work was that some fungi have always fruited in spring, we've known that, whereas most fruit in the autumn. But we were finding that lots of fungi now fruit in the spring that never did before. And so that means that they're active over the winter, so their ecology is changing. Now, the reason I brought in this example is just to show you how important the amateur fungal community is. When we say amateur, sometimes people think, oh, they're not very skilled. They jolly well are skilled. Amateur just means they're not being paid for it. These records, when Ted Gange, the father, started collecting them, he didn't know why he was collecting them other than because it was a fun thing to do. But those records are so important. We couldn't have got them in any other way. And we've gone on with teams from across Europe now to analyse huge data sets and seeing all sorts of things. That just shows, you know, you cannot argue against that. Amateur mycologists are hugely important. And there's more and more scope as well in conservation, taxonomy, and indeed in helping university researchers to do experiments. Another of my students is working on ash dieback disease. And he's been trapping spores around Britain just to see when the ash dieback fungus is most prolific, etc., etc. And he's got, I can't remember, 6, 7, or 8 different sites around the country. Now, he couldn't visit those every week to collect the sticky traps with the spores, but he's got volunteers involved. We need the amateurs. We really do. Really, and they've got a very important role to play in the future as well.
Really exciting. And I think for a lot of people who get into mycology as an amateur, which just means you love it, you're not necessarily being paid for it, it kind of opens the door to science. I know that did that for myself, but because it's such uncharted territory, it kind of beckons you to explore more, and suddenly you need to learn things about biology or about science. So I think for a lot of people, it has that amazing effect of pulling us just to be interested in science in general. And then once you're interested in science and biology and natural systems, you naturally get into conservation and environmental issues. And I think it has all these amazing after effects. And so you've painted some vivid examples of that happening and how the amateur is contributing in a very real way. That's really exciting. And I just love hearing from people that are career professional mycologists or ecologists, because it really reinforces that idea. Instead of just hearing it from me, who is an amateur, say how great amateurs are, it's nice to hear it from someone who's in a position of a lot of experience and professionalism. How do you think the expanding exploration of kingdom fungi is going to fundamentally change human society? So obviously that's a huge question, but maybe, you know, in 20, 30 years, where do you see the science of mycology going? Where do you see some different applied aspects coming into play? And maybe how will it change, you know, either legislatively, socially, how will it impact some big change on our societies?
Well, I'm hopeful that there will be huge changes. Obviously, I'm not sure that I'm quite so far-sighted as to be able to know what will be going on in 30 years, but I can hope. I mean, I hope very much. And I think we can see that this hope is almost starting, that people will stop being mycophobic and realize how important fungi are, and that we have to effectively look after fungi in the way we try to sometimes for animals and plants. We have to look after fungi in the same way, because if we don't, we ignore them at our peril. They are crucial to the functioning of our ecosystems. Of course, we need to know how to control pathogens, fungal pathogens, by changing our agricultural practices and who knows what. So that's an important thing we need to sort out. But of course, the other things, in addition to that, we can use them to clear up some of the messes that we are making from a pollution point of view, perhaps from a plastic point of view. We can use them as foods, not just eating them in the way that you've already said that you liked the fruit body. That's all well and good. We can do that. We can make foods from them directly, from their mycelia, but also fungi used in the creation of all sorts of food or chemicals in food, like citric acid and things into soft drinks. There are masses and masses of things. They're great chemists. They make all sorts of chemicals. They make medicines too. And the obvious one is penicillin, but we know of many more. And there are many more things to be found in fungi, you know. So I think the sky is the limit. And I hope that from being perhaps a minor discipline in universities, which in the past we've just been tagged on to botany, probably as a result of Linnaeus classifying fungi as plants all those years ago. But I hope that people pretty rapidly realise the importance of fungi and really focus very much more attention on them. That is my hope. There's great hope and great exciting things that can be done, you know.
That hope that you just explained so beautifully, that's why so many of us get so passionate about it. In a world with so many man-made issues where we seem devoid of solutions, fungi just keep coming back as the central solution in so many ways. So yeah, I fervently hope for a fungal world that you just outlined. Now, a couple closing thoughts that I ask all my guests on Mushroom Hour. The first one is one of my favorite because I learn about all these amazing new fungi I've never heard of. But what is a mushroom that you love and why? And we've talked about a lot of different fungi already, especially as it pertains to wood rot. But just a mushroom that comes to mind that you really love and why?
Well, it has to be one that I have mentioned rather a lot. It's the sulfur tuff fungus, Hypholoma fasciculari. It's a beautiful fungus, but the mushrooms are beautiful. I mean, it's toxic, it's poisonous. You don't eat it. And if invertebrates eat it, they too will die. But it is such an important decomposer. It's a great fighter. Not many things beat it. And it forms these fantastic networks. And I've spent 40 years working on it. And to me, that is one of my favorite fungi.
Yeah, and those are the ones that also, not bioluminesce, but under a black light, biofluoresce, which always find fascinating.
Yes, that's fascinating too.
Another big, broad question. What has a relationship with fungi given to you? You know, what perspectives has it brought to your life? How has it changed your life? But what has a relationship with fungi given to you?
Well, I think it's given to me excitement. I wake up every day excited to go to work and to think, what am I going to find out today? What new exciting things? What experiments can we do? What are we going to discover? What have other people discovered? It's excitement, I think, that's what fungi have brought for me. A very fulfilling life.
That's fantastic. And it comes out of every part of the what you're sharing with us. That excitement comes through so beautifully. So I definitely see that. And then what is the lasting impact that you hope to make with your whole body of work, the research you've done, the questions you've asked? What do you hope the legacy or the lasting impact of that is moving forward?
I hope that we've made a baseline of information. People often say to me, well, don't we know that already? No, we don't. We don't have the basics of the ecology of decomposer basidiomycetes. And I think that's probably what I've spent the last 30 or 40 years doing, is trying to get that baseline fundamental information upon which I hope there will be great science done in the future.
One of my favorite phrases is we stand on the shoulders of giants. And I think in your case, you've saved a lot of researchers and a lot of people 40 years time, which spanned over hundreds of individuals who build on your research. Collectively, who knows how many centuries you've saved science by establishing some of this baseline information. It's all fascinating. And you have just been an absolute joy to talk with. I look forward to future episodes where we can talk about some of these other issues that you've explored. But just thank you so much for coming on the Mushroom Hour and sharing some of your passion and knowledge with us. It's been amazing.
It's been my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.